Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the MadTech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, and I've taken to just starting to introduce myself again. I haven't done that for weeks. That's for the benefit of new listeners. And I'd like to welcome our guests for this session, Chris Stark, Senior Director Product Management for Oracle Data Cloud. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Rachel. It's great to be here. Very exciting and excited to look at the agenda we've got today.
Yeah, cool. Really good to have you. And Kieran O'Kane, safely back from your Canary Islands bunker there in Tenerife. You've made it back to London.
That is correct. I have returned like a swallow flying from Africa from its nesting in the winter to the summer. I followed the vaccine. So.
Oh, I see. You've come back for the vaccine.
Well, hopefully. Hopefully.
That's interesting. UK vaccine tourism. Anyway, let's get started with first news story of the week I wanted to chat through with the two of you. This was an interesting brief piece that came out on some online shopper spending statistics released from Retail Tech News, telling us that UK shoppers spend more online than anyone else in the world. The total volume of online sales in 2020 in the UK was third globally. Only behind the US and China, which is really interesting since both of those countries and economies are significantly larger than the UK. Average spend per person in the UK is nearly double that of the average spend per person in China and about 20% more than the average spend per person of shoppers in the US. Online shopping represents approximately 15% of salary for UK consumers, which was a little bit lower than the percentages we saw in China, which was somewhere near sort of 18 to 20%. And there was about another four or five countries with much smaller economies who were ahead in terms of proportion of average salary committed to online spend. The biggest online retailer for 2020 was Amazon, no surprise, globally. But what was also interesting is that over in China, JD.com outranked Alibaba, I believe, for the first time in 2020. And considering that JD.com is a somewhat smaller retailer to Alibaba, I found that really interesting. But for the purposes of this conversation, I wanted to focus specifically on that UK data. We've speculated a lot over the last 12 months about severe lockdown and stay-at-home measures have done to shopping behaviours and shopping habits. We know that online consumption has grown globally, but it's really interesting to see that online consumption in the UK and, you know, shopping dollars spent is quite significantly higher than other markets. Do you think that's because we've been so badly hit by the pandemic, or do you think that's saying something about the sophistication of the e-commerce marketplace and the online retail opportunity for consumers in the UK? And I also want to know if you think that's going to persist and what you think, obviously, are the advertising and marketing opportunities associated with that. Chris, let's start with you all the way from New York. Tell us what you're seeing.
Absolutely. And I'll start probably lamely with a bit of anecdotal data. For me, so my family, we lived in the UK for about 8 years till about 2014. Personal experience. So this data point may be useless, but I got quite comfortable with using services like Ocado. And I lived in London. And I moved to back to the US and we lived, more in a suburb. But it was many years before any of the similar services were comparable in terms of experience. It just wasn't worth continuing the habit of buying online. And I wonder if that's just a data point. It could be a big city question, but a data point that sort of shows a higher level of maturity or sophistication in the online experience and the e-commerce experience that the UK retailers are offering, so that the base was even higher when we got into lockdown. That'd be my kind of first volley of a thought. The variation of salary versus the sort of consumption suggests possibly efficiency, and maturity. If you're still trying to build the kind of retailer space, the e-commerce space, you're spending more, you're investing more to kind of get to a stable spot. But it was kind of surprising that large number, again, beyond my anecdotal experience.
I think the Ocado example is really good because actually they're, for any of our international listeners that might not know who they are, I'm sure plenty of people do, but there'll be some that don't. They're a really successful online grocery retailer that has been around in the UK for, I'm going to say 15 years, possibly even longer. And so they've got really sophisticated infrastructure, including some patented warehouse technology that they've now tried to onward sell to other industries that need that kind of sophisticated warehousing and technology. And I wonder if that just, not only is it a success story for Ocado in itself, but it actually started a sort of a chain of behavior change amongst consumers to the extent that everybody just got very comfortable with expecting a really good online grocery shopping experience. And particularly if you live in London, right? So delivery was always very convenient, not really much of an issue. I wonder if also the fact is, if you're looking at the UK, in terms of footprint, it's a much smaller country in terms of size, physical size. Does that make the logistics less challenging? I'm not sure.
Certainly fulfillment and logistics is a key component of successful e-commerce, right? You're going to have to be able to have the stuff you need and be able to deliver it fairly quickly. So if that infrastructure is already in place to some degree, again, you've got a head start.
Yeah. Kieran?
I'd say probably a couple of things, right? So one, I would say that the UK market is very sophisticated compared to most markets in the world. And it does seem to be an outlier in Europe in a sense that it's almost like an American mindset in terms of innovation. So it's no surprise to me that the retailers probably have been sort of evolving their online solution for years, and it's made it easier to buy, let's be honest here, right? So it's just the Ocado is a good example, but generally most of the retailers, the e-commerce sites in the UK are pretty decent. And the user experience is pretty decent. I mean, look at the success of many online clothes retailers, and they've just absolutely nailed that solution. So that's probably encouraged a lot of behavioral change here over the last couple of years, and COVID has just accelerated it. So people who were doing their shopping online have realized now that it's easier to go, shopping offline in stores now through the COVID restrictions, have just migrated to buying online. And this is what was bringing over more people into that mindset. So I think post-COVID, you're going to have a lot of people keeping that going because, the collection, like the delivery and you can returnables, all that stuff has been nailed over the last, say, 10 years, right? So retailers have got it wrong in the first instance, but they've got it better over, they've iterated their product. So I think it's just a combination of like, really good infrastructure, sophisticated solution, and the actual COVID itself. And probably a fourth thing, which is bloody boredom, right? If you're sitting in the house, what else are you going to do? You buy crap all day.
You're saying that we were more bored here in the UK than anywhere else in the world?
Well, let me put it this way. Hey, the Brits and the Irish generally like a beer during the winter, right? And COVID is mostly taking place, the worst of it anywhere from October till now. So haven't been able
over the dark and cold winter months. So
when you can't drink,
all of us Northern Europeans had to find something else to do.
Exactly.
Well, it's really interesting.
So retail therapy has replaced social drinking, basically.
Boozing therapy. It's interesting though, because the second two countries after the UK in that study were Denmark and Norway. And
there you go.
Right. I didn't actually think about the drinking element. I thought about perhaps the sophistication of infrastructure, size of the country versus, population. They've got an even bigger advantage in those countries.
Yeah.
And sort of just general sophistication of e-commerce economy.
I think the first thing is it is sophistication, and like a lot of those retailers have had to iterate pretty aggressively to keep up with the Amazons and the rest of them, right? And a lot of the retailers have had like their physical businesses hammered over the last couple of years, right? So, okay, there are like digital first brands, but generally speaking, a lot of the offline retailers, like Argos is a good example, like they have a fabulous e-commerce solution. They've had to iterate it over the last 10 years because they've been the rival of Amazon and other like big American providers, particularly Amazon. Amazon's the only one really. Walmart isn't here, so. But that's kind of like lit a fire under a lot of these smaller, I would say not smaller, but like country specific platforms. And they have really have done a great job in building a product. And I think COVID has just literally accelerated that.
One final thing, and I wonder, Chris, your point of view on this is, I wonder as well if this is just coincided with the sort of deprecation of the UK high street retail shopping model, largely based on this notion that everybody goes to a high street that's almost walking distance from where they live and they're expecting to see the same shops no matter what neighbourhood they're in. And those retail changes haven't been able to survive.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for that. And that, I guess, is just another form of infrastructure or, you know, the social conventions of geography and buying habits. Again, having not lived in the UK for a while, I was pinging some of my colleagues on the topic and they were definitely saying, yeah, it feels like the high street's dead. And here in the States, compliance with lockdown is somewhat of a regional thing anyway, but you know, it's all back to behaviors. If you're already accustomed to loading your SUV up and heading 10 miles to the local big box store, it's not going to change too much. It's not about public transport. It's not about you know, anything that sort of is associated with a high street idea.
That leads us nicely into the second story I wanted to chat about, which was a great piece from Seb Joseph at DigiDay, writing about ASOS looking set to grow their in-house programmatic business. And what's interesting is that they've advertised for a number of vacancies, but these vacancies are not focused on growing their sort of automated advertising capabilities in-house, but instead supporting advertisers with their campaigns running on ASOS as a publishing site, as a site of inventory. Perhaps this is ASOS setting up a marketplace that's very much geared towards attracting retail media spend. So looking to get advertisers to spend money where they think they're going to find consumers at point of purchase, or the way that they would allocate their shopper marketing budgets in a previous context, in another context, whether that's offline or in a different online environment, and creating that sort of online retail place that is you know, certainly not directly competitive, but a similar sort of model as some of the large e-com providers. It feels as though this is, if the premise is accurate, this could be a real blueprint for some other online retailers that have got an opportunity to corner budgets that were used on, you know, in-store marketing. It also feels as though it's the good option for advertisers who can now no longer rely on third-party cookies for targeting and measurement and tracking functionality. So maybe depending on what kind of data they're able to get from these retailer sites, this is a way to try to get more granular detail and information about who they can be offering some of these products to at the point of purchase on online retailers' sites. Chris, what did you think about this story?
A great one. I think I forget where I read it, but the idea that media dollars will follow the other dollars. And so you just see the if the consumers are flocking more and more to e-commerce space and you're spending more time online with e-commerce, there's your opportunity for attention, for eyeballs. And I think that's not just, you know, shopper marketing of yore, but just being able to have your brand associated and reassociated, and awareness and reminders of brand identity there. So it makes a lot of sense that as brands like ASOS can increase their footprint. I know they recently picked up Topshop and several sort of mixed off and online retailers, that they're getting to the point that they probably could really muster a lot of first party data to offer something important. And I think that's, so my observation is, right, you probably could sort of have almost table stakes using things like context to make placements inside a retail space. But probably where it becomes interesting and competitive is then being able to use your data. And if you've got lots of data, scale and richness is going to be, you know, is going to win the day. So the question I would pose, and sort of back to this, is, you know, how far down the list of retailers can you go before you start to have too much fragmentation and the data is not useful enough? Or, you know, you've got niche spaces where it will work simply because of the vertical that you're working in.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think one of the points that Seb raised in his article as well is that actually, you know, whilst it seems like, you know, perhaps not specifically with ASOS since they're a fashion retailer, but it seems like this model is, you know, is one that could be replicated where you could see CPG brands getting quite excited about accessing retail media. Yet he had quoted a CPG source saying, we're interested in it, but we're not convinced that we're actually getting the appropriate data back from retailers in order to enrich the way that we're serving advertising. So that's another interesting point, right? Kieran, I know you're particularly interested in retail media and what you like to refer to as commerce.
Well, media. I can't recall what you called it, commerce media. And retail media, I think they're both similar, but it is a class space. I mean, I think that there's a couple of points here. I think that we're going to see more of this because Amazon's kind of almost like, they kind of were the forerunner for this. But HookLogic was an ad tech company that was bought by Criteo in 2016. And I think that they sold too early. I think they were basically the vanguard of this type of solution from an ad tech point of view, helping a retailer set up their own sort of internal ads. And they could have been worth, I'm not joking, they could have gone public. They could have been worth billions in this. I think they could have been like the Shopify infrastructure, but like for the retail ad tech structure that I thought Criteo should be, but kind of got distracted with retargeting. There's a couple of things I want to add to that. The amount of money that's sitting in in-store retail marketing is huge, right? And it's always been one of those things that we talked about at Exchange where a lot about, right? It is significant. It is multi-billion dollar stuff, particularly in the UK, and globally it's probably worth hundreds of billions. You know, the CPGs basically do deals with their supermarkets and they do in-store advertising, they do TV advertising. So that budget will probably shift across. And I think this is the biggest opportunity ad tech will see this decade, right? So there's three things I think that are above all else for ad tech to think about. ID and privacy, first and foremost. Chris can allude to that and building some interesting products over at Oracle. CTV is a big opportunity because it's going to see money shifting from linear to addressable. And then the final one, I think, is commerce media. I think this is absolutely massive, right? Because I think the more, like your last story, Rachel, the more that we spend time online buying stuff, the more opportunity there is to build these types of advertising-based products, prospecting, all of the rest. So then you have to think about how you build the infrastructure around that, right? And all the great ad products that you can build off the back of that, right? And it's not just the finite amount of money in this space, right? This is a, you know, multi-trillion dollar business, right? This is fucking huge. Excuse my language, obviously I shouldn't be dropping the F-bomb in these words, but I can't help myself. I'm so excited. Data Oracle.
We'll just edit you out,
don't worry. But my point is there's a huge opportunity for advertising technology tech companies to kind of reposition and build stuff for around this. And it's not just ads, it's measurement, it's targeting. To Chris's point, it's like, you know, if you go further down, how does that make sense? Okay, what about keyword technology, semantics and contextual pages, right? You might have to product fit, suggestions, recommendations. There's so much you could do here. It's so exciting. And I think ASOS is doing the right thing. They're saying, look, there's a pot of free money here, right? Think about it like Tesco and, you know, Sainsbury's, how much money they brought in from the marketing piece and CPG when they ran those TV ads and they did all the in-store stuff. How much money those CPGs give them? ASOS is going, look, we have, you know, millions of people coming to this site every day, every month. Why not spend the same money with us advertising your products on this and getting an upsell? And it depends on the sophistication. Obviously, they're starting out to figure it out, right? But that's where I think ad tech helps fill the gaps around how do you build, you know, recommendations? How do you build specific keyword targeting? How do you build specific contextual targeting? How do you integrate that ad stack into demand? How do you measure? And I think this is cool because it's much more privacy focused because it'll be logged in data, it'll be keywords, contextual. Yeah, I love it. I think it's great.
And if you just on the back of our previous story, right? If we have kind of pushed a high watermark to e-commerce usage, then consumers are generating more data for these retailers, and generally more data lets them do better optimization.
And also it's a better experience, Chris. It's not like you're in the mindset to buy something. You know, you don't mind, like, you know, you just bought a pair of shoes. You don't mind if there's a pair of socks on offer as well. Like this, whereas you're on a bloody website and where you're just reading a recipe and just getting bombarded with like outstream ads and just because you want to lift the yield on the page.
If you think about also, right, in some ways, commerce marketing is sort of sucking away a little bit of search marketing dollars, right? You start doing your searches inside the marketplace itself.
Yes.
And whereas in search, all you can get is the resultant destination. In theory, using ad tech inside a marketplace could let you do more than just like cart abandonment ads and the last click opportunities, right? So you said it right. Like there could be a lot of new ad products here that are more just about awareness in the right space.
It could be like, I think about the Chinese apps, it could be, you know, bottom of the funnel as well as top of the funnel. Why couldn't you do like really cool creatives on the page, video stuff, like with, you know, like people doing live stream, you know, makeup stuff or whatever they're doing. Like, you know what I mean? There's a whole element of like top and bottom of the funnel that there's so much more you could do there, because it's just the environment, right? You don't feel as icky about your mindset's different. You're there to shop, right? It's fine here, you know, here you're in a different set of mindset.
So if this is kind of, you know, big opportunity for ad tech, what do you think we're going to see in 2021 then? Are we going to see other businesses try to adopt a similar model to ASOS? Are we going to see specifically focused ad tech tools, you know, being developed or being repurposed?
So I think that you'll see some entrants testing the waters, right? And as I said, that there's a lot that you can bring to bear, but if you don't have the scale, it may be hard at first to kind of draw some of those advertisers in. So you'll probably see some folks, some retailers with a decent set of data giving this a shot. We'll probably validate through the likes of, you know, Walmart and Walgreens and all the other ones that have started running more efficiently in the last couple of years. But obviously, that's going to be where ad tech steps in. And hopefully, and I can't speak too much to it, but, you know, the ability to kind of translate first party data into stuff that can be used by others will be a big area to make sure that data is effectively applied. And that'll be the big movers.
Yeah, I think there'll be vertical plays like CVS built their own solution in the US. I've kept saying that Boots should do something similar in the UK.
Yeah, we just talked about it in the podcast 2 weeks ago, actually.
Absolutely own that. Mm. And then there's loads of verticals that could do that. But then, like, there's probably smaller online retailers that could be aggregated as a play by ad tech or by ad networks or whatever to build a first party solution. I think it's great. I think it's really interesting. I think like that money is new money, and I like the fact that Chris said that taking money away from Google is always a nice feeling. Like, so
did those actual words come out of Chris's mouth? I mean, you know,
I don't think I uttered that brand in particular.
It's a kind of like a blunt tool in many ways. You go to Google and you search, and then you go somewhere else. So, I mean, the fact that you're in the Boots website and you're looking for suntan cream, and then next thing you know, there's like sunglasses and all this other stuff comes up because you're going on holidays. Like, that's a really interesting sort of opportunity for not only for the retailer but like for the advertisers as well, because they're able to upsell to the consumer.
I can't remember what it was like to go on holiday. So can we please not talk about holiday related activities? Thank you very much. So some of us haven't been in the Canary Islands for the last 3 months, Kieran. Some of us have been in London, stuck inside their own homes. Anyway, moving on to cheerier topics. Third news story of the week. British-owned and international market research and data analytics company YouGov, adding to their profiles product. So they have a significant profiles product, which is basically a consumer research profiling tool that stretches across lots of different data points and demographics to try to give brands, advertisers, marketers, and anyone else that wants to use it. In fact, government institutions as well, an idea of how to understand and profile populations, audiences, segments, etc. They've added a specific sports profile to that overall product, which is called Global Fan Profiles. And they're using that to provide all of that information about sports consumers and fans of sporting events, sporting teams, and sporting games. They've now expanded that out to include esports as a specific subcategory. So where, I mean, you know, 2020 was really the year of talking about gaming in advertising and marketing. And I mean, esports is its whole own world in addition to gaming. But it's really interesting that YouGov have added this as a specific fan profile. It says something, I think, probably about not just the pace at which the gaming and esports industry has grown over the last 12 months, but also its recognition of the fact that all of those professional organisations that are involved in sponsoring, but also rights holders and partnering with esports organisations and esports players to professionalise that industry are requiring more sophisticated data segments. They need to know, they need to understand who esports fans are, where to find them, how to profile them, and what they look like. So I thought this was super interesting. Keen to know what the two of you think are the potential advertising and marketing opportunities here, of course, because anything that starts to get a little bit more granular in terms of exactly who this particular segment and audience is starts to become really interesting. We've talked a lot on this podcast and various other ExchangeWide channels over the last year about how interesting the gaming audience is becoming, because it's just becoming so much more mainstream. We can now no longer make assumptions about who gamers are because they're effectively everyone. Is this going to be a really interesting tool available to brands and advertisers to determine the same sorts of things about an esports audience and to understand how they can you know, get their products in front of esports fans? What do you reckon, Chris?
So the first thing that came to mind when I was reading this, it reminded me of you know, the old Comscore top 500, right? At some point in the emerging or the maturation of an area, you got to find some measure that has a little bit more granularity. And so for anybody who's not over 45, like the Comscore top 500 was kind of a way to get a crude demographic slice at a property level. And this sort of felt like the same thing, right? It maybe not at the property level, but I think you hit the nail on the head, Rachel. The sponsorship money is rising for those for that space. You see, like, Twitch usage is just booming. So if marketers are going to want to spend their money, they're going to need to know more than basic data points. And we've become accustomed to what programmatic can offer, so it stands to reason that. I think people will throw money at it as it's growing, but increasingly they'll get a little bit more picky without real data. So it seems like a natural step. The YouGov people must have been watching the numbers on Twitch and deciding, yeah, we need to make something work here.
Yeah, muscle in on that, Kieran.
Yeah, it's a maturing market, isn't it? Like you know, it's hilarious that gaming is sort of like, it's always seen as sort of something like a trivial, you know, niche, and actually it's bigger than the entire film industry, which is incredible in terms of, like, revenue generated. Yeah, I think, like, you're talking about the next generation. This is a really good, interesting move by YouGov. I mean, you don't see Comscore doing this or Nielsen doing this, which says a lot about those companies.
Absolutely. I was just thinking the same thing, because I was thinking if this tool, depending on, because it's designed not just to provide demographic data, but also, you know, data on behavior, characteristics.
I mean,
could this become a tool that could be used in tandem with ad tech and martech, existing ad tech and martech tools?
Definitely.
You could actually see this as a planning tool, right? This is probably what YouGov are trying to do, which is quite interesting and very smart, actually. To kind of, like, load that into a buyer at one of the big agencies to kind of figure out what audiences they're buying against. Absolutely, it could be layered in as a segment or as a sort of, you know, as a benchmark or a panel. It is interesting because it is a demographic that is not addressable in terms of the typical advertising, because probably most of these kids are using ad blockers or are on systems that don't have ads, like Twitch. and Discord. So Discord's obviously the chat app that they use, although most people are using it at the minute to kind of like Royal Wall Street and try and bring down Citadel and all the rest of it. But it's a great move and badly needed, because that data is not really readily available for buying these audiences. And I think it's interesting because we've just launched a new syndicate for ad tech, and we're looking at businesses that are first party platforms, and one of them is a gaming platform, and we look at it from the lens of first party, and that's the way that's where the value of these platforms will be. Like, I mean, obviously it's the utility of the platform, but the valuable first party data on these people who would spend a lot of money on gaming, you know, hardware, software, everything, like, and obviously then that translates into other parts of the lives as well. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so if you're playing games for 6 or 7 hours, you're going to need some, you know, crisps and Coke and, you know, and soft drinks and all sorts of crack to keep you going through the arduous.
Wee small hours.
Well, yeah, man. Like, you know, it's there's a huge opportunity here. But where do you hit these kids? Like, outside of like these platforms, because a lot of them don't watch linear TV, despite what like the barb people will tell you. And most of them have, you know, are using sort of apps. So where can you get them? So this move by YouGov is very interesting in terms of trying to segment that audience. So I think it's quite interesting, and it's a great I guess it's a sign that the mature brands, the CPG brands, are obviously crying out for this, because, you know, they can't just have old codgers like me eating Doritos and drinking Coca-Cola every fucking day. Like, you know,
he was thinking about what, Karen, what you said about or sorry, maybe it was you, Rachel, but, you know, the fact that we haven't seen Nielsen or Comscore here, and I wonder if some of this is due to the fact that if YouGov was already focused on events, that sort of orientation put them in a different vantage point. And then, you know, events, you start to get a bit hazy, right? There's esports, or I was just thinking about, you know, Epic Games in its Fortnite starts to have concerts.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and so if you're already there and you're trying to measure those, then suddenly you can start to measure, you know, real concerts, which again, may be part of the YouGov registry of things that they're monitoring anyway. So it does kind of make sense that they'd already have had, you know, their head in the right game.
The live streaming aspect of this is important, because that's where esports is really, you know, powerful. Like, it's like, you know, games being played by teams watched by, you know, millions of fans. Like, so yeah. I mean, that's what Twitch is all about, really, isn't it? Although it's kind of evolved the product a lot, but
yeah,
and you don't have to have cardboard cutouts of fans in those kinds of games. You can actually, you know, be present.
That is very true.
And I mean, it is interesting to speculate as to what exactly took YouGov to this part of their global, you know, fans profile. Is it that they saw growth in esports because they were so connected with other gaming, including physical games, sporting games, and also other online games? Or is it actually because they just, you know, they just kind of stumbled upon the data opportunities and the behavioural opportunities? And also, I wonder, you know, it'll be really interesting to see what the behavioural characteristics and real demographics are of this audience, because we might find that actually, you know, esports fans are not all, you know, teenage boys sitting around drinking Coke, eating crisps, a bit like gaming. You know, fans, players, you know, where everybody games to some extent these days. So maybe esports is going to become a much wider category too.
Well, it's the passing of the torch, though. Like, it's like, this is a whole generation that's growing up, like, and this is going to be part of their entertainment mix. And that's, I guess that's what YouGov is kind of like addressing. Like, you know, TV is one part of it, CTV is another part of it, but we live in a fragmented world, and have, you know, all these data points will be important to buyers and marketers and brands to try and figure out who they're selling against or what they're buying against, you know.
Yeah, and you're right. And, you know, the esports, maybe the, you know, hardcore esports fans that might still be teenagers at the moment are going to grow up and become older consumers and still be playing esports, I mean, if they get the opportunity, right?
Their kids will be playing like 3D bloody whatever technology comes along, like, so, you know, some interesting businesses out there are building like next gen sort of 3D stuff. So which is just it's just evolution.
Okay, I'm going to move us on to the second part of the podcast. Tell us about what you're focusing on specifically at ODC at the moment. What's the thing that's grabbing your attention? And maybe tell us a little bit about what we can expect from you guys in 2021.
Gotcha. Yeah, absolutely. So my area of focus in ODC has been on the context side largely. But what I think has been particularly exciting about legacy acquisitions of Grapeshot into that fold is I'm going to speak more generally to just where the industry is heading as well, right? I think the renewed attention on context lends itself to additional investment and consideration of context as almost like a first class targeting citizen, which I don't think it always has entertained or has enjoyed, right? And that I think that shift alone, you get marketers thinking a little bit more about what can context do for them, and so how does that translate into what the likes of ODC are doing, and you can see this in other bits of the market. Essentially, right, with a contextual solution, as long as you can get access to a piece of content, you can kind of slap a whole bunch of different labels on it according to whatever your classification system is capable of doing. You've got the legacy stuff, which we define a particular category, esports, and we say this fits or doesn't fit this definition of esports. And you could, of course, imagine an infinite range of just definitions like that. And that's I think where we've already come to. But the interesting stuff is now if we really think of context as a first class citizen, then there's an increased willingness, I think, to start merging lots of data sets into context. And so you already see a little bit of this popping up, right? Where sort of offline or cookie-based behavioral data is now being used as a seed to inform contextual definitions. And you've got, tools like Word2Vec and, deeper ML type processes that break individual pieces of content down into lots of sort of atomic elements. And then you can just figure out which chemical compositions you're looking for effectively. And this is where I think it gets exciting, is that suddenly the URL is just an identifier for a thing, just like a cookie is an identifier for a thing. And now what you're doing is you're finding groups of groups of identifiers modeled around whatever that is you need. So in other words, it's sort of taken to the natural extension. We can carve up all of the content space into whatever discrete buckets that we need. We can do it according to those sort of best fit approaches. We can do more predictive models on real outcomes. And I think that's where this gets interesting. How do you look at a piece of content, not as it's about esports, but that it is a piece of content that regularly generates purchases genuinely, like real outcomes. And so the ability to start building those models based on that data has been part of the excitement of being part of Oracle Data Cloud, where we've got kind of both of those assets. And I think we'll see that emerging all around the industry. And if suddenly you've got that capacity, then I think the second piece is being able to sort of package those things alongside identifier solutions, reg data, and whatever else emerges in the next year or two, or a melange of targeting solutions. But being able to do that so that you can go to a marketer and say, okay, what's your outcome? And here's the five different slices of identified and de-identified sets that are generally non-overlapping that are going to get you the outcomes you need. That must sound a bit pie in the sky, but it's the fact that suddenly context is a first class citizen that's seeing everybody investing and looking more and being open to mixing and matching the data in that way.
Chris, are you saying that that's interesting you said like a first class citizen, because it was sort of like the annoying little cousin that came into
My god, yes. I get the budget in the cushions beneath the sofa. Right?
Like the disparaging comments you get about context, if it was like 1990, and it's like going, well, that doesn't make any sense. But do you think this is sort of the elevating of contextual status is going to see lots of interesting sort of innovation in the space like this. So what you're talking about there is really, really granular in terms of how you break down the page instead of like making assumptions about the user, right? Based on their activity, tracked activity, because it was tracked activity on there. Now you're looking at the page and how why they're on that page in the first place. Like, what's the sort of idea? But so taking the sort of context of the page and the semantics of the page, you're able to kind of like build a better idea of the intent of the user or what the user is actually there for, that would help you match back to appropriate marketing or appropriate ads for that user.
Yeah, I think there's probably two ways of looking at that, Karen. So on the one hand, and this almost relates back to the conversation about the retail side of things. Like, what are all the different attributes that are present on this page? And they could be semantic in terms of language on the page. It could be image-based. It could be things like dwell time, right? These are all sort of non-identified signals. And how do you unpack that, or rather munge it together to have a better understanding of intent? There are examples that are about sort of predictive models to mitigate shopping cart abandonment, for example. So, you know, what are the ticks behaviors that you're seeing on a page or on a site that tells you a person's about to abandon the cart, and how do you use that information to quickly do something to jar them back in? The flip side is, and I guess this is where I was talking about kind of getting into the real atomic elements of a page. It works both ways. If I know that, you know, these three key elements seem to keep showing up in all the places where I get this kind of behavior, then I can go look for more of those key elements. So say you find a page that people tend to convert with, or for whatever reason, right? You can't just go target that one URL and get any scale. You got to find all the other places that look close enough like that. And not just in a traditional contextual sense, right? It may not be that it's an esports page, but it may share other semantic and or other elements that you could find in several other pages, which suddenly gives you a scaling capability. So I guess there's two lenses there, right? If you're looking almost inwardly focused and you've got a set of data, then the contextual elements can enrich the way that you make decisions about your consumers. And then you use the same capability as a translation layer to find other media opportunities using the data that you've got.
It's really interesting because, you know, a bit like Kieran just said, it just adds so much more weight to contextual than we've ever been able to before, right? So, you know, people can really start taking it seriously as a not just an alternative to another way of finding users or targeting users, but actually to something that works better, that's superior. Are you currently working with marketers in this capacity at the moment, or is this to come, or is this what stage are you at?
This is definitely something that we're working on. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about much where we are at this very minute. Yeah.
I'm sure
that's certainly one of the, you know, one of our key intentions is, Oracle Data Cloud has two amazing, several amazing assets, but it's got a lot of rich sort of data sets on the identified side. It's got sort of the grapeshot engine on the other side, which is highly malleable and allows you to do lots of different configurations. As we see marketers beginning to get a bit nervous about opportunities after cookies dry up, there's a bevy of solutions that sort of sit out there that they're wondering what they can do. But there's certainly an opportunity here to show what context can deliver above and beyond just finding more pages about esports.
Thanks very much, Chris. We've run out of time, but thanks very much. It was a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Definitely lovely. I really enjoyed today's chats. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
And it was, it was good to see you. We miss you over here in London. Was it 2014 that you moved back? That feels like a lifetime ago.
It was a lifetime ago. It's now more time.
You need to come to ATS London this year.
You do, actually. You need to come to ATS London this year.
Make it a date.
It's later in the year. We'll tell you about it later on.
Yes. Perfect. Not till November. So you've got time.
Fantastic.
Get your vaccination and your ticket now. So you can get, like, we're going to vaccinate people on site.
There we go, an ATS vaccination.
Yeah. You get a free jab. You get a free jab with your free ATS jabs. London ticket.
Yeah. That would be a brilliant idea.
It would be a good way to get some high-risk individuals, individuals vaccinated, definitely.
Yeah, so you get vaccinated on the way in, you get your ticket, and then you get a free beer on the way out.
There we go.
Brilliant. Thanks, Chris. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Kira. Good to have you back in London.
Great to be back.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.